Welcome back to the program. This past Sunday, the New York Times ran an article by Tony Scott on those books and movies that take us inside baseball, that is, explain what's really going on behind the curtain in areas like sports and politics. Back in 1968, a 26-year-old reporter by the name of Joe McGinnis wrote a book that took us inside the Nixon campaign of that year and in so doing redefined how we viewed politics and the media. As Theodore White did in 1960, McGinnis redefined the genre of political journalism. Since then, he's continued to push the boundaries of journalism, from the cases of Jeffrey McDonald to the veracity of Janet Malcolm. Today, he's taken on a subject that, frankly, most journalists have been afraid of, that is, trying to find the real Sarah Palin. It's amazing, really, that after so many years in public life, no reporter has gotten anywhere near as close to the Wasilla that Joe McGinnis explores. He did so by practicing the first rule of journalism, go there. And in going to Alaska to seek out the real Palin, he would find a life that is trashy, cheap, and truly American. It is my pleasure to welcome Joe McGinnis to the program today to talk about his book, The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. Joe McGinnis, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
Great to have you here. Is there a real Sarah Palin? Is there anything real about Sarah Palin that can be defined?
Well, yes, there's a real everyone, actually, somewhere. But we just never got to see it because all she projected was this utterly false image. And frankly, the mainstream media did a very, very poor job of trying to look for the reality behind the facade in 2008 and ever since. She projects herself as this hockey mom with a deep commitment to Christianity, an extreme form of Christianity, I should say, and family first and family values and abstinence and anti-abortion and like to end the separation of church and state and make America into a Christian republic. And really, that's all smoke and mirrors. Behind this is a disorganized, egocentric, vindictive, uneducated woman who has only her self-interest at heart.
And one of the things that is so overwhelming in all of this that really calls out for understanding is the degree of hypocrisy that is inherent in almost everything that she does.
I think you've really nailed it there, Jeff. Hypocrisy is probably the one word that describes Sarah Palin. Or hypocrite would be the word that would describe her. And that's why I get into some facets of her personal life that I would not have gone near with another politician. For example, I don't even know how many children Rick Perry has. I don't even know if Herman Cain is married. Maybe I'm just not paying enough attention. But these people do not parade their families around as ornaments and show them off in ways that are designed to appeal to people and advance her political career. Palin does this, and therefore, you know, because she calls herself this great hockey mom who's raised these five children and shows them off, I think it's important for people to know that actually, when those kids were growing up, she was by and large an absentee mother. Even when she was physically present, she didn't care for them. When Todd, who was working up on the North Slope in those years, would be up there for a six-week shift, I'm told by many people who knew the Palins very well, who visited their home, that those kids just didn't get enough to eat. Sarah wouldn't cook dinner for them. She never washed their clothes. She never made sure that they washed themselves. She was just not an attentive mother. She just didn't seem to care. This was a very poorly kept secret in Wasilla. She was kind of infamous in her little carpool for the mothers who took kids to school, that the poor Palin kids, they never got any mothering. Now, that wouldn't matter. That really wouldn't matter, except for the fact that she hypocritically portrays herself as this all-American hockey mom who personifies the family values that she thinks we should all have. Well, she doesn't have them herself.
Right. To what extent do you think that her doing this, putting her personal life front and center the way she did, in some ways had the effect, and it worked to a certain extent, of insulating her from real exploration by the media during the campaign and during her public life in Alaska?
Well, I think to a great extent, she succeeded. Certainly, in Alaska, when she was elected governor, she was elected on the basis of this false image of this woman of integrity who was going to stand up to big oil, and who again was this Christian mother, this fresh face, this fresh voice. By the time she resigned as governor of Alaska, those approval ratings that had been 90% had dropped down to below 30%. So the more people saw of her up there, the less they liked her. Over 2.5 years as governor, people in Alaska got to look behind that image and see what was really there, and it was not very appealing. The national media never did this. She was sprung as a surprise. We all remember what a surprise she was in 2008 by John McCain. And 2 days later, she's speaking at the Republican convention, and to give her some degree of credit, she electrified that convention. She, to the proper audience, she can read and deliver a prepared speech very well. She does have some qualities as an entertainer. She has a charisma and a sense of showmanship. That's her strength. And the media failed, in my opinion, by just allowing themselves to become so dazzled by that performance that they made no effort to look behind this mask and to see who was really there. I'm only one person, and I spent 3 weeks in 2008, 3 to 4 weeks in 2009, and then 4 months in 2010 in Alaska on the ground doing old-fashioned reporting, research, talking to people, going around, talking to hundreds of people. I found all these things that I put in the Rogue. The mass media with the big news bureaus and all the money that they have at their disposal and all the staff they have at their disposal, they didn't find out any of these things. I wonder why that was. I think it was because they just weren't looking, because as even Howie Kurtz of the Daily Beast and CNN said a couple of weeks ago, this was a symbiotic relationship. Sarah needed us, but we needed her too. She drove ratings. She drove web hits. She drove circulation for newspapers. She was a golden goose, and nobody was in a hurry to kill her because she was delivering for them.
Part of it was also this atmosphere of fear and intimidation that she created. I mean, as you talk about, it was sort of the 10th grade mean girl mentality writ large.
Absolutely. I have an op-ed page piece in USA Today this morning that talks about why I found it necessary to use some, not all, but some anonymous sources in the Rogue. And the big reason is because people were afraid to speak on the record about her. You know, when I moved in next door in 2010, she really freaked out. She went on her Facebook page 3 hours after she learned that I was there, and she virtually accused me of pedophilia. She said I was peering over the fence, looking into the bedroom window of her 9-year-old daughter with binoculars. You know, the most crazy stuff. She had these fantasies, and she wrote them down as if they were fact. And people all over the country believed that as fact. And I started getting hate mail. I got death threats. There were the first 3 or 4 weeks I was there, Jeff, not a day went by when somebody I met for the first time didn't offer to loan me a gun. I had the new mayor of Wasilla open his desk drawer, his lower right-hand desk drawer, reach in and pick out 3 handguns and said, "Here, Joe, you can take your pick of these, or if you want, you can have them all." I mean, this is the atmosphere that Sarah has created up there, so it's no wonder that people were afraid to talk. Even so, I have more than 60 named sources in that book, and those are people who courageously did allow me to quote them by name. Some of them have, in fact, in the past couple of weeks, gotten some threats of their own. One gentleman being told that it's going to be a long winter and he better watch his back because he might not get to see spring. This is the kind of thing that's been going on with the Palins up there for their whole career in public life. Both she and Todd, frankly, the word I would use to describe them is bullies.
The interesting thing is that it is still going on even within the context of mainstream Washington. You've been criticized, and I don't want to get too far afield from Palin, But you've been criticized for unnamed sources in a town where unnamed sources are de rigueur. It's like criticizing gambling going on in Casablanca.
It's ridiculous. In the USA Today piece, I cite a website called anonymoussources.org that keeps track of the use of anonymous sources by mainstream media. Since February 10th, 2010, that's just about a year and a half, both the Washington Post and the New York Times have used anonymous sources more than 2,000 times each, and the Wall Street Journal more than 6,000 times. So for them to then turn around and accuse me of somehow journalistic ineptitude or lack of responsibility for using a handful of anonymous sources to talk about somebody who's able to threaten their livelihoods, if not their lives. I mean, that's a level of hypocrisy that rises to the hypocrisy that Sarah Palin herself has practiced.
I mean, nobody criticizes the many, many, many mysterious and anonymous sources that Bob Woodward has used over the years.
That's true. And Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein had an anonymous source who we might remember as Deep Throat, without whom there would not have been Watergate hearings, without whom Richard Nixon wouldn't have been forced to resign as president. Jill Abramson, who's now the executive editor of the New York Times, and I quote her in my USA Today piece today, said that the Times has been using anonymous sources, the Times and other major media have been using anonymous sources for centuries, and she's proud of it, not apologetic. So I think it's not fair for Beltway types and other mainstream media who rely on anonymous sources for their own livelihoods to turn around and try to bash me for doing the same thing that they do on a daily basis.
Beyond all of these personality aspects that we've talked about with regard to Palin, there is the fundamental aspect of competence and the lack thereof. I mean, when you look at, as you do in The Rogue, her tenure as mayor of Wasilla and then as governor, you see a level of incompetence that is just remarkable.
It's always been there, her incompetence. You know, in the early 1990s, Sarah applied for a job as a dispatcher with the Palmer, Alaska Police Department. This was about the level of competence that she had. She might have been okay as a dispatcher, although she undoubtedly would have quit that job too, because she has a short attention span, she gets bored, she wants to move on to something else. However, when she was elected mayor of Wasilla, she was able to hire someone, using town funds, of course, city funds, she could hire someone to do her job for her. That allowed her to go shopping in Anchorage two or three days a week, to keep very, very short office hours, to focus on her image, while someone else actually did the work of administering the city. That's the only job she's ever had that she hasn't quit, and that's because she was able to get someone else to do her work for her. She has never showed competence at any level because she just doesn't have it.
And along with that lack of competence is a total lack of curiosity about anyone or anything.
Well, there's an incident that I describe in The Rogue at her first city council meeting as mayor. At the end of the meeting, a friend of hers, somebody who liked her, but was worried by her ignorance and her failure to understand basic principles, in this case of economics. This man came up to her with a copy of Michael Heilbronner's book about economics. The Worldly Philosophers is the title of the book, and it takes a look at economics through the lives of some of the key figures, key economists throughout history. And he handed her the book, and she would not even take the book out of his hands. She said, "I never read anything that might conflict with the values I already have." She didn't want to learn. She has, not only isn't she curious, she's actively incurious, because she said reading something new could challenge her beliefs, and she didn't want to take that risk. All she needed to know, she learned from playing basketball in high school, and she learned by attending services at the Radical Fringe Assembly of God Church in Wasilla. That's where she got her education.
Talk a little bit about those religious beliefs, because they are more than just fundamentalist Christian. They are this diminutist kind of beliefs that that really drive her in so many ways.
That's been true since second grade. She started in a group called the Missionettes at the Wasilla Assembly of God, and these little girls would go around knocking on household doors and try to hand out leaflets like Jehovah's Witnesses to try to persuade people to come to the Assembly of God. Basically, this Christian dominionist, the strain of dominionism in evangelical Christianity, believes that biblical law should replace constitutional law as the system of government in the United States, that the 235 years of constitutional law that we've had should be replaced by the laws of the Bible. They want to end the separation of church and state. They want to prohibit the teaching of evolution in our schools. They want to overturn Roe versus Wade. Sarah Palin has told people in Wasilla that she knows that Jesus Christ will return to earth during her lifetime on it, that these are the end times. She's preparing for the rapture. She said she wanted Wasilla, then Alaska, and ultimately the United States to be the sort of place that Jesus would be happy to return to. She wants to make America a Christian republic by her own definition of what that means. And that a woman like this, with those beliefs, could run and could come within a few percentage points of the vice presidency of this country without the media ever taking a look at that, that's, to me, that's the most appalling failure on the behalf of the media. Forget her personal life. The most important revelations in The Rogue are about her religious beliefs, how extreme they are, and how determined she has been to force the rest of us to accept her version of God, of religion, and of what America should be.
One of the things you talk about is that even when she was mayor of Wasilla, that her staff at the time spent a considerable amount of their time trying to keep her to not talk about these religious views.
You know, she would hold prayer meetings in her office as mayor. I talked to a former development director of Wasilla, somebody who she hired and fired. She was notorious for firing people. She should be on that show instead of Donald Trump, you're fired, because really it was a reign of terror. She became mayor, and she fired all department heads who were not Christians, and she replaced them with people from her church and with her high school friends. Talk about cronyism. She was the queen of cronyism. But this development director described to me driving towards City Hall one day, pulling into the parking lot, and seeing a group of seven or eight people standing outside the mayor's office, leaning against the wall and pressing their hands on the wall as if they were trying to hold it up. He went inside and spoke to a secretary inside and said, what's going on? He says, oh, no, you'll get used to that. Those are just people from the Assembly of God. Whenever Sarah is actually in the mayor's office, they all gather to press their hands against the outside wall to communicate the word of God to her through the wall. You know, this is pretty zany stuff. She belongs to a prayer group up there headed by a woman named Mary Glazier. Mary Glazier claims that through the power of focused prayer, she can drive demons out of cities. She claims to have discovered that somebody who was applying for a job as chaplain with the Alaska State Prison System was actually a witch. And she organized focused prayer groups to destroy this individual. And she claims that she caused the man's car to blow up, that he developed cancer of one eye and had to leave Alaska to seek medical treatment. She claims this as a scalp, as a great victory for her prayer, the power of her prayer. These are the people that Sarah Palin has been hanging out with her whole life.
One of the things that you talk about, and you alluded to this before, is that the people that know her best tend to like her least, and she has this unique ability, not a good thing necessarily, to inspire a tremendous amount of hatred. And talk a little about that.
Hatred and fear. She's always been a vindictive person. She's always been a bully, and she's never shown any loyalty to anybody who's ever sacrificed themselves to advance her career. This started when she wanted to get a particular woman, a staff member of a Republican state senator's staff up there, to become her campaign manager when she ran for mayor of Wasilla the first time. And to get the woman to quit her job and become campaign manager, she promised her that as soon as she was elected, she would name this woman deputy administrator, and the two of them would run the city together. And the day after her election, she called the woman in and said, well, it wouldn't look right if I hired my campaign manager, so, you know, you're out of a job. And that was the end of that. She's done, I've heard similar stories, you know, literally dozens of times. As governor, she fired her legislative director because this man, who was in the process of divorce, started a relationship with the estranged wife of one of Todd's best friends. When the guys found out about this, he went to Todd and said, you've got to do something about this. And Todd said, oh, don't worry, I'll have Sarah fire the guy. The guy's name is John Bitney. She did fire him, and she later ridiculed him in her book, Going Rogue. Bitney was quickly rehired by a senior member of the Alaska State Legislature because he's a very, very competent guy. And as soon as the Palins heard this, they went to that state senator and said, we want you to get rid of Bitney. You shouldn't have hired him. We don't want him working in politics. We don't want him working in for the state anymore. We want him gone. And they never let up on this. There's that state trooper. This is the famous Troopergate incident, who was married to Sarah's younger sister, Molly. They got divorced. It was a very bitter divorce. And Sarah, to retaliate against this guy for divorcing her sister, spent 3 years trying to force his dismissal from the Alaska State Police. And when the commissioner of public safety, after Sarah had become governor, the commissioner of public safety, Walt Monaghan, finally said, Sarah, I simply can't do it. It's against the law. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't do it. You can't fire this guy. They have a union. You know, he can only be fired for cause, not just because you don't like him. So what she did, she said, well, maybe you can't fire him, but I can fire you. And she did.
One of the things that is clear is that there's no filter on her response, particularly to stressful situations.
Well, I think that clearest indication of that was her reaction when I moved in. You know, I was about to sign a lease on an apartment in Anchorage, almost an hour and a half away. I would have had a three-hour commute every day. 3 hours before I signed the lease, I got a call from a woman who said, I hear you'd like to live in Wasilla. I have a house that Todd and Sarah have been renting, but all of a sudden they pretty much broke their lease and left me in the lurch here, and the house is now vacant, and I wonder if you'd like to rent it. So I said, I'd be interested. Where is it? And she said, well, it's actually right next to Todd and Sarah. And boy, when she said right next to, she wasn't kidding. These two houses are about 15 feet apart with a 10-foot-high fence between them. So I move into this little house. The Palins have the big house. I'm sitting on my deck 3 nights later, minding my own business, preparing to barbecue something for my dinner, and Todd walks around the fence and says, who are you? What are you doing here? I come down and I introduce myself. He finds out that I'm there writing a book about Sarah, and he says, well, we'll just see how long you stay here. And he shakes his finger in my face and goes stalking back across the lawn. 3 hours later, Sarah's on Facebook making these ridiculous charges, and she didn't stop there. The next day, she's on the Glenn Beck radio show, and they're talking about, how Todd deserves a medal for not punching me in the face, and what can they do to get me out of there? And this is stalking. This is invasion of privacy. All these hysterical things. So I actually learned something very valuable about her character just by moving in next door and seeing that my simply being there, not even doing anything to bother them, that triggered this hysterical reaction, and that caused her to start telling all these really vicious and inflammatory lies about me. I would never have expected that from a woman who already had been through the stresses of a national political campaign, but the fact is she has no filter, she has no impulse control, she lashes out without thinking. You saw this on her Twitter posts for many months before she finally hired enough staff to keep her away from her keyboard when she was going through one of her hysterical fits. And, you know, I think we really dodged a bullet in 2008, and I was so relieved to hear last week that she said God had told her he didn't want her to run for president this year, and that she always had to listen to God, and he made her choices for her, and God felt she would be more valuable in another capacity, and all this other stuff that she used in her announcement. But we are not going to have Sarah Palin to kick around anymore, and I think we should all feel very happy about that.
In many ways, over time, even though there hasn't been, as we've talked about, the appropriate exploration of who she is, and until now, little by little, it was beginning to wear thin on the public, I think.
I think it was. You know, she's a one-trick pony, really. She can feed red meat to her base, and she can come up with slogans that are memorable. Think about death panels, for example, and more recently, she's been trying out crony capitalism. She doesn't really know what these slogans even mean, but they sound good. And I think that her superficiality, her lack of depth, you know, there are some intelligent conservatives out there. I might disagree with them politically because I'm not one of them, but I certainly respect their opinions and the fact that they have some substance in terms of their own intellects. Sarah doesn't have any of that. She was not an adequate representative for any cause from any part of the political spectrum. The people in Alaska figured that out first. The people of the United States, I think, had figured it out to the point where recent polls showed that almost 70% of Republicans did not want her to run for president. This is as strong a repudiation as a political figure could ever face. And in the face of it, she backed down. She's gone back to Alaska. And frankly, I think she'll stay a staple of reality TV and maybe Fox News, although I'm not so sure Roger Ailes is going to want to keep her around after her contract is up. And in terms of politics, I think she's finished, and I say thank God she's finished, but you'll still see her because she can't live without the limelight. She might not eat well. She might not eat a balanced diet. She may have she may or may not be taking diet pills. I don't know. You know, she's notorious for her poor eating habits, but she can go without food, but she can't go without public attention.
Right, and she really has elevated this sense of victimhood to almost an art form.
Well, you know, yeah, art form, but bad art.
Right.
You know, but for a period of time there, until people began to, you know, to hear the same tune over and over again and got tired of it. Yes, it was like Saint Sarah. Remember when, in summer of 2010, Newsweek had a cover photo of her practically with a halo around her head and called her Saint Sarah. This was the way she had, and anybody who attacks her, you know, it's like attacking Joan of Arc. The Anchorage Daily News actually called her the Joan of Arc of Alaskan politics. And to attack her was to attack everything good about America. And she was very successful. She has a great sense of the dramatic, and she was very successful in portraying herself as a victim when actually she was a person who created victims.
Well, two things I want to touch on before I let you go, Joe. One is her attitude, and Todd's attitude even more so, about race.
Well, there's documentary evidence that Todd is a racist bully. There was one black kid in the whole Wasilla school system in the 1980s. When he was in seventh grade, Todd had moved into Wasilla just for the start of 12th grade. He came in from out of town. He quickly became a popular guy in Wasilla High, and he and two friends, 12th graders, high school seniors, took the 7th grade black kid to a rock quarry behind Wasilla High School and beat him senseless, just beat him and beat him, just because the kid was black. Now, that kid stuck it out in the Wasilla schools, showed great courage, wasn't going to be driven out of there by bullies, took a lot of other beatings over the years. Now he lives in California. I can't tell you where because I promised him I wouldn't disclose his location or use his name. But I talked to him on the phone last year. He's now a successful entrepreneur. He owns his own software company. He's a very successful, very articulate, successful guy. And he had his memories of that were vivid. And he said, sure, Todd was a racist bully, but so is everybody else up there. That didn't make him any different. Now, Sarah, when she, well, first she goes off to the University of Hawaii at Hilo. And according to her own father, she came back after only 3 weeks because there were too many dark-skinned people out there, and they made her uncomfortable. When she became governor, one of the first things she did was to order the firing of 24 low- to mid-level state office workers simply because they had darker skin. She said, when I walk through the state office building and I see all those dark faces, that makes me uncomfortable. I want them gone. I want them out of here. She fired 24 of them. The NAACP was preparing a discrimination lawsuit to file against her, and they decided not to go through with it because at that time she was at the height of her popularity, and they thought that would cause further backlash. Now, there's one incident in her life that where she had the sexual encounter with the basketball star Glenn Rice that I write about, and people say, oh, how scandalous. Why should we care what she did when she was a young adult? Well, we shouldn't, and the only reason that that story is relevant is because there's a widespread story in Wasilla that afterwards she freaked out the way she did when I moved in next door. She said, oh, I can't believe I had sex with a black man. Oh, this is so awful. Oh, my God, I can never forgive myself. And according to John Bitney, the legislative director, 20 years later, she was still so traumatized by this that that's what drove her to fire all the dark-skinned faces, dark-skinned people who worked for the state. They reminded her of her encounter with Glenn Rice. Well, after months of digging, I discovered that all I heard was Sarah had sex with a black athlete and it freaked her out. I finally find out that who the athlete was, and it turns out that he's somebody very, very famous. It also turns out that he's a very, very classy guy, a great gentleman, Glenn Rice. I called him on the phone, and I said, Glenn, here's a story that I've been hearing. I said, first of all, do you remember Sarah? He said, oh, I remember that like it was yesterday. She was a really sweet girl. We had a lovely time together, and in fact, we stayed in touch by telephone for months after that, right up until the time she got married. I said, well, that's funny because I hear that she totally freaked out and she had this meltdown in horror that she'd had sex with a black guy. And Glenn just laughed and laughed, and he said, Joe, whoever's telling you that story just doesn't know the truth, because believe me, that never happened. So I put that story in the book. It's actually kind of a sweet story. Mm-hmm. The two young people get together, they enjoy each other, and they stay in touch. They had quite a bit of affection and fondness. So at least in that instance, Sarah, she didn't freak out. Maybe she pretended to try to save face with her friends, but the fact is that was not the reason. It wasn't her trauma about Glenn Rice that caused her to fire all the state office workers. So, you know, she's a woman of many contradictions, but the one thing that goes beyond all the contradictions is that, as you said earlier, Jeff, that she just hasn't had the competence, the level of competence that would have permitted her to do any job in public life. And again, we should all be very happy that we're not going to have to worry about her anymore.
And as outrageous as so many of these stories are, the one that sort of is the penultimate story is the one we still don't really understand, and that is what the real story is with respect to the birth of Trigg.
Chapter 19 of The Rogue is devoted to a very careful analysis of what we do know. And I don't go beyond where the facts take me. I don't have a theory. I describe myself as Trignostic. I don't know if that Down syndrome baby is hers or is not hers. I do know that the story she tells of the events leading up to his birth simply could not be true, starting with her water breaking in Dallas and culminating almost 24 hours later in a tiny hospital in Wasilla, where she said she gave birth to this boy. It just can't have happened the way that she said it did. What really did happen? What is the real story? I don't know. The questions remain, and they are legitimate questions, because she was a candidate for public office. Now, if she goes back to private life, I'd say then it's nobody's business anymore. And it may be, and I truly believe this, that it may be that the big reason why she decided not to run for the presidency next year is because she didn't want the real story about that child to come out.
And finally, as somebody that has covered politics and politicians for the past 40 years, What is the fact that, this woman, with everything we've talked about for the past 30 minutes, what is the fact that she became, as you say, a few percentage points away from the vice presidency to a president that would have been 70-plus years old?
Yeah, she was a few percentage points for being a heartbeat away from the presidency. And she's by far, I think the record is clear on this, by far the most unqualified candidate for national office we've ever had in the history of American politics. And the fact that the media, because they were dazzled by her superficial charm, allowed her to come that close to that much power, is probably the greatest failing that the media has had in the past 50 years. And it was a collective failure. It wasn't just one or two people not doing their jobs. Nobody did their jobs. So finally, I've done their jobs for them, and a whole lot of them don't seem to like it.
Joe McGinnis, the book is The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. It is just out from Crown. Joe, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Jeff, I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.